You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Hi guys, this is Deep Tran from American Theater Magazine and the producer of this podcast. So I wanted to give you some quick pre-show notes regarding the sound quality of this episode. We tried a setup we had never tried before in the opening segment, which was two microphones talking with a third microphone over a Skype connection. Suffice to say, there were some technical difficulties which we did not realize until after the segment was recorded, and one of our microphone, Rob's microphone, was not properly picked up. And that is why Rob sounds like he's 2 feet away from the microphone. My apologies to Rob and to the listeners. I hope it does not affect your listening experience too much. And also, hashtag nonprofit life. Enjoy the episode and thank you for listening.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner-Kent, the editor-in-chief of American Theater, and I'm here with
Allison Considine, the staff writer.
And we have a special guest today. We have a couple of special guests today. First, we're going to talk about the controversy about the Great Comet, Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet, the casting controversy, with an actual marketing professional, Karen Greco. Hello, Karen. How are you?
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. And then we'll segue to an interview with James Still, who's the playwright in residence of Indiana Repertory Theater. He's been the playwright in residence for 20 years there. He's celebrating his 20th year. And it's a fascinating conversation. He actually is a resident of California, but he is a resident playwright in Indiana Rep. There's a lot of frequent flyer miles there. It's a fascinating conversation with James. So but let's start off with the sort of latest internet controversy, which I'll try to make this as brief as possible. Essentially, Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet is a Broadway show, an acclaimed, very immersive Broadway show that started, and we've written about it over the years many times. It started at Ars Nova, as sort of an environmental immersive space, then it moved to a tent, and then a little bit another tent. And then it finally it miraculously went to Broadway. It was kind of a miracle that it made it there. Not because it's an interesting through-sung piece based on a part of War and Peace. Anyway, it's done fairly well. It didn't win the big Tonys, right? But it definitely has a following. And when it got to Broadway, it added someone named Josh Groban to the cast, and that helped sell a lot of advance tickets. Dave Malloy, the composer, wrote a beautiful new song for him. And, you know, the show has been doing okay, doing very well with Josh Groban. It's hit the issue that a lot of shows do that don't have, like, a Best Play Tony or a huge star, and that is once Josh Groban left, the ticket sales have gone down. They put Ingrid Michaelson in, who's a singer-songwriter, into one of those other parts. But to replace Josh, they had Dave Malloy go back in the lead role. He originated it. They cast Akirete Onaudawan, best for short, Oak, we'll call him, Hamilton star, as Pierre. And I think by most accounts, he's been doing a good job. Hasn't been burning up the box office. He's a Hamilton cast member, but he's not a marquee star. He was supposed to be in it through the end of August or something like that. And it's a little sketchy on exactly what happened here, but Mandy Patinkin had seen the show and expressed interest in it. And the producers looked at his schedule, they looked at Oak's schedule, and they decided to put Mandy in the show and take Oak out before his time was up. And that was announced to great fanfare. Broadway fans were excited. Mandy Patinkin is going into a show. But it looked bad to many people that an African-American actor was being pulled untimely and early from the show, the run. The optics of it, you know, even though, as many pointed out, The show is extremely diversely cast. It has one of the most diverse casts on Broadway currently. And so after a lot of back and forth and outreach, Mandy pulled out of the show, seeming to imply that he was not aware that Oak was going to be out of his contract early. And it's a little unclear exactly what went down backstage. I would just say that there was a lot of back and forth about it. The show's, Oak is leaving August 13th. No, that's this Sunday. No replacement has been announced. There's a lot of turmoil and chaos. I'm trying to keep this as brief as possible. on top of this, Deep wrote a piece. Allison, you want to sum up with Deep's wonderful piece that was up last week, sort of put a cap on the conversation so far.
Yeah, so I think Deep did an excellent job of looking at the issue in a broader sense, looking at it more than just a race issue and kind of tackling Twitter and social media and how that kind of just these comments can spur into debates that are more than about, you know, what the issue might actually be. So I think Deep did a great job of just kind of expanding it and being like, all right, well, let's take a deeper look at what the optics are of this situation. Mm-hmm. And Deep mentions in it too, like the marketing of the show, like what could have been done differently to bring in a new audience that Oak, you know, certainly Oak has a following. Why weren't they capitalizing on that?
Right. And that's where I think we bring you in, Karen, because I think there has been a sort of, I mean, I just admitted to you that we critics and reporters are sort of armchair critics of what producers and marketers do. And we think, this looks bad, and this could have been done better, and why can't they market a show without a star? So I wonder if I could ask you, I know you haven't worked on Broadway per se, right? Or did you used to? No.
No. I try to avoid it as much as possible.
Right. Okay. So you've mainly done off-Broadway and off-Broadway productions. But I don't know what your take on this. Did marketing play a role in the way this was handled or mishandled?
I mean, you know, I'm not part of Great Comet. I'm not part of the marketing team. I don't know what the conversations were when they have those meetings, those weekly meetings with the producers between press and marketing and all of that. I will say that the reason for a show's success and failure is probably, there are 10,000 reasons for it. Mm-hmm. Part of it could be, not knowing their marketing budget. What is their marketing budget? To be honest, I haven't seen a whole lot of Great Comet ads out there. I haven't seen a whole lot of, you know, I think that they probably had a very limited marketing budget. I will say I did check out their internet presence. Their Facebook page is pretty robust. Mm-hmm. I know one of the things that sort of was being discussed online was sort of, you know, in terms of marketing was the roundabout production of Little Foxes and how image wasn't the best marketing image. So I jumped over to Roundabout and looked at their Facebook was surprisingly not nearly as active and engaged as Great Comet. So I think that they're doing something right in terms of social media engagement over there. But finding audiences is really hard. It's really hard. I mean, you know, to put it into perspective, a Broadway show needs to sell about 16,000 tickets a week.
Okay.
And at $100-$150 a pop, I mean, this is an expensive proposition for a lot of people. So it becomes very, very difficult to fill those seats.
Right.
And, you know, and star casting is one way that producers try and do it. Not like that's a panacea. Just because you have a star in the cast does not mean the tickets are going to sell. But it does mean that you will get a lot of earned media hits from the press.
Okay.
And that's worth something. Even if it ultimately doesn't move tickets, it is generally, you know, you get a lot of free media impressions that you wouldn't normally get if you didn't have a star.
Right. So in other words, I think you elaborated this on Facebook that a star will buy you basically press coverage, right?
Yes.
Which is what you call in your trade earned media. Which is free media, right? Basically.
Correct. Like
free without paying for ads. You're going to get in the newspaper. And that, but you were saying that doesn't guarantee ticket sales. It just guarantees coverage.
Exactly. It guarantees coverage. It's the coverage that you want because you haven't paid for it. And, you know, audiences are savvy and they know the difference between marketing and PR. So they know that an editorial hit is going to be more valuable. That's your social proof, right? Oh, well, the New York Times announced this, so that must mean there's something special about this project and maybe we should think about going to see it.
I guess my thought on it was, of course, like Josh Groban was leading this marketing campaign that they had, but there wasn't so much happening for who the audience of this musical was outside of Josh Groban fans. Like I mean, I follow The Great Comet on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, but I didn't feel like they really tapped into the people who would really love this show. Cause I feel like Josh Groban fans are very different than the crowd that was following Great Comet from Ars Nova to The Tent to Broadway.
Right.
So I don't know. I just feel like they didn't really tap into who those people were that didn't know about the show that should.
Well, I'm curious because I feel like because the show did have this, you know, pretty long life off Broadway and off Broadway with where it started at Ars Nova and then moved on and on and on, you know, it sort of already played to that built-in core New York audience that will go off Broadway, that will go, you know, that want to be the first to see something, or, you know, they follow Ars Nova and they think Ars Nova does great work. So, and then they're going to go back because, oh, now it's set in this tent and that's really unusual.
Right.
So like, you know, by the time it sort of morphs into a Broadway show, I think you've kind of already exhausted that audience with the amount of runs that this particular production had, which is why they needed Josh Groban to go in, not only for you know, for the sizable audience that fans that he would bring with him, but, you know, also the press coverage.
Yeah.
Because there's only so much Little Engine that could press coverage the Great Comet could get at that point, because it kind of felt like it already had happened, you know, because it was two tent runs, correct?
Yeah, it was two tent runs. I didn't think about that. I think what you're also saying is the Josh Groban fan base, and just in general, the sort of star name recognition helps with non-New York audiences, which is I don't know, something like 60% of Broadway receipts or something. It used to be flipped. Someone has talked about how maybe 20, 30 years ago, it was 70-30 or 60-40 New York audiences versus tourists, and now it's exactly the reverse, you know.
Correct.
Yeah, I wonder if I do know that it does have followers who are repeat followers, right? Some people who go back more than once if they can afford that somehow. But I wonder if those people were Josh Groban heads or if they were it was actually been hard to untangle now that Josh is out of the show. I did see a lot of social media just that seemed to be excited about the whole thing, just like the whole. In other words, people who maybe Josh Groban fans went to this and were blown away by how strange and interesting the staging was, and they fell in love with Dave Malloy and his work, and vice versa. I don't know if Dave Malloy fans became Josh Groban fans, but in any case, it did seem like a happy convergence, and they haven't quite found, you know, one that has set fire to, you know, people's imagination and box office the way that pairing did, you know?
Yeah. I think another surprising thing for me, when this was all happening on the internet a couple weeks ago, I didn't even know that Oak had started at that point. There were no interviews. I was expecting to see posters or promos around the subway. Like, I feel like that was a missed opportunity because I didn't even know he was starting.
Again, I mean, I think, and this has nothing to do with how talented that man is, because that man is very talented. I mean, this is strictly speaking from a sales generation point of view, right? If you put him on a poster, are people walking through Times Square, for example, big billboard, are they going to recognize him? Are they going to be the one saying, that's the dude from Hamilton? Because at this point, there were so many dudes from Hamilton, right? I mean, between Lin-Manuel and W. Diggs and all of these guys, you know, are they going to say, oh, that's the dude from Hamilton? Are they going to recognize that? Are they going to put it together? You know, I mean, these are things that marketers are sort of confronted with, you know, that they're going to have to sell the show and sell this person. I mean, is he on social media? I wasn't sure. That wasn't clear to me if he was. I think he is, correct?
Oak himself, I believe. Yeah, so. Yeah, he's so. On social media. I don't know what his social media presence was during this controversy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sort of clear. I know that he put something up, you know, about how he wasn't coming back to the show and all of that. You know, so I'm just wondering, you know, did he rally his fan base? I mean, you see this in movies and Hollywood right now, where you have actors who are getting cast because of their social media following.
I saw Sophie post.
And this is something that is a very real thing that's happening in Hollywood. I think we're going to start to see it trickle down over here.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you want to, into theater, if you want to sell tickets, you need to make sure that the people that, you know, the audience is coming to see, people that they want to see, people that they feel invested in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's part of what made Hamilton such a huge success, is that Lin-Manuel Miranda had this groundswell of support. He had an army of social media fans that were just ready for him to do something, and they were jumping on board right away and saying, "We love this and we support you." You know, and if you don't have it, that is becoming more and more important, and being your own sort of marketing machine, being your own influencer to get your projects up, get your projects sold, you know, and actually create some sort of internet. Well, I mean, really. Also in person, that's important too, but being able to create this internet army that can come out and support you.
I wondered to ask you, Karen, if you were working on this team and this had gone down, obviously the decision about casting wouldn't be yours.
Yeah, we can only work with what we're given.
So
yeah.
If you're in a strategy session with the producers of Great Comet, what do you say to them? What should we do now?
Is Ariana Grande available? I mean, seriously. I mean, you know, right at this point, the damage is done, right? You can't take this back. You can't fix this. I think that they should, I mean, truthfully, they should have never tried to buy out this actor's contract. It was really a producing error that they didn't think past Ingrid Michaelson's leaving to get somebody into that role who might generate ticket sales, because they clearly knew that Oak maybe wasn't the person that was going to really generate that groundswell of support.
Sure.
Because it was Ingrid that was all over the place.
Yeah.
When the announcement started coming out and all of that. And so the fact that they actually didn't overlap their contracts, you know, to make it so that either, you know, she stayed on until he was gone, or like that there was no contingency plan in place, was just, I mean, frankly, that was where the mistake was made.
I see.
And Oak should not have suffered for that. He should not have been asked to leave.
To carry the show, right?
Or to carry the show, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's really unfair.
Right, right. Yeah, it seems like bad all around. Again, I felt uncomfortable saying bad producing, bad marketing, because I don't know what actually went down. It did seem like there were mistakes made, right? It seems like a show like Dear Evan Hansen, for instance, has no stars in it. It's made a star out of the lead, right? And
right.
He certainly had a following going into that. You could argue that Lin-Manuel, although he was well known, was not a star when Hamilton was the star. I feel like certain shows do get elevated and do get pushed because there's so much want to see around the show itself. And I felt like Great Comet almost could have been that show. It has been that show to some people, to a certain audience. I always felt like it was, especially at the tent, and to a certain degree on Broadway, was sold as a unique event. You have to see this. You have to be in the room for this amazing, immersive event. And that, I don't know how well that connects with the Broadway audience, that they're going to see something where that doesn't even look like a theater. It looks like it's been blown out, and and it looks like a theater. It looks like there's no back to it, right? There's seats everywhere.
I mean, what's sort of interesting about this is they've put up a production that appeals to a millennial audience, right? Like this is the show that the millennials are going to want to see. They want the experiences. They want to break the fourth wall. They want to be involved in the production. It's why escape rooms do so well. At least that's what we're being told, right? But, you know, I think maybe there is if 60% of the Broadway audience are tourists, maybe they're not millennials, maybe You know, they're at, maybe the ticket price is too high. Maybe there's a lot of things. Maybe they're saying, I hated War and Peace. They made me read that in high school. this is not an easy book. This ain't Sweet Valley High, kids. This is a tough text that we've adapted here, you know? So I do think, like, on the surface of it, it's like, God, this sounds like something that's like a Sleep No More that's going to do all of these crazy things, you know? But I think for whatever reason, there's a barrier there that said maybe it should not have been on Broadway. Maybe they should have done what Sleep No More did, which was just have an event space and do it there. And why have this sort of Broadway fixation or Broadway goal? But notice Sleep No More built a lot of stuff around it. So I don't even know how much money Sleep No More, the production, is actually making when they have a restaurant, they have events, they do all of these other things in the McKittrick Hotel that is, could be subsidizing the show.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
And not knowing their actual running costs, I'm not sure what Great Comet's running costs are and what the recoupment money is that they would need. I mean, how is this an expensive show to produce on Broadway? Probably.
I saw a number that they've only made back about 20% of their...
I think it was 20%. So far, of the $14 million that has gone into it, I think the operating costs per week were about $700,000. And
okay.
Oak was bringing around $9 million, but Josh Groban was bringing over $1 million a week. So,
and they only recouped it 20%.
Well, so far.
With Groban bringing in $1 million a week.
Right.
How long was Groban in for?
I mean, it opened last fall. Is that right, on Broadway? I don't know.
Had a pretty substantial run.
It wasn't a short celebrity limited run. It was he ran with the show for quite a while. And then I know they announced, when they first announced it, it was already said Dave would go in for a few special, you know, like alternate with Josh, for those who just wanted to see Dave in this role again.
They're your super fans, right?
Right, exactly. And I guess the lesson is that there are super fans, and a lot of them were millennials. It's probably true, and they might have burned through. They've seen the show as much as they want in the soundtrack, and maybe they don't need to. I don't know.
I mean, on the topic of millennials too,
yes.
Just thinking, like Dear Evan Hansen for one. I haven't seen a show that has really tackled social media in the way that they have. I mean, it goes hand in hand with the theme of the show as well, but just the. They've really jumped into doing a lot of Facebook Live videos, which is kind of new.
I think. Cast and stuff, and backstage. Or?
Well, one thing that they did, which I've never seen before, they released the cast recording on Facebook Live, kind of last minute. They had a midnight listening party for all their fans, and it was huge. And tons of people from across the country then started following the show more from that point. But they do a lot of live videos with cast. The cast backstage and the ending image in the show with You Will Be Found. There's a picture, all these hundreds of pictures of students surrounding Evan Hansen. And so the show has now started to incorporate fans' photos in those on stage. So there's little things like that that I think they're like really, really into like tapping into these millennials that might not be getting to New York and kind of creating this, just energy around the show.
Is it millennials, or could it be that new generation? What generation
after,
Z, right?
Are
we talking about? Are these?
I think these are teenagers, so I think they're right on the cusp there.
So we're looking at high school kids. We're looking at, I mean, because you're looking at the audience that made Wicked,
right?
Wicked turned into is sort of, for whatever reason, they're able to tap into that. Teen angsty sensibility where the teenagers can find some sort of, you know, common ground with the characters. It was funny. I was doing something with my teenage goddaughter, and it brought me to University of Maryland with her and a whole bunch of teenagers from across the country. And Hamilton was huge.
Right.
I mean, kids from, you know, Alaska wearing the Hamilton t-shirts. I don't even think it's gone out on tour yet. You know, these are kids that haven't seen it, but love the idea of it. They maybe are listening to the soundtrack.
Wow.
They found each other, and they were talking about Hamilton and how they were excited to finally see it when it showed up in their town. You know, so for whatever reason, it tapped into these kids, and that could be what's sort of creating this groundswell. Maybe their parents are traveling, they're coming to New York to visit, and they're saying, well, what show do you want to go see? I want to see Hamilton or Dear Evan Hansen. Like, there's your tourist market if you're traveling with the teens, right? You're reaching these kids. Whereas with Great Comet, let's go have some vodka, mom and dad. Yeah. You're not going to be able to tap that audience. It doesn't play into the family dynamic of, well, come and bring your 15-year-old kid to Broadway. You know, if you're going to do that, if you're going to go see something serious, you're going to go see Evan Hansen, or you're going to go to The Lion King, or, right. You know, something like that.
I get that. It's a tough needle to thread. Your advice to your clients who are not Broadway, does it have to do with social media, a big part of it now? You say get your actors on social media, or
you know, it's funny. I'm actually going to be talking more about that to smaller clients. The institutional people, clients that I work with already have social media teams in place, and they work really hard to, you know, be on social and be engaged and all of that. It is the smaller, smaller theater companies with less, they just have less resources that you kind of need to say, well, you guys need to be more on social and do this and do that and do a little bit more advising. But, you know, I remember about a year ago working with an institutional client, a last minute show was coming in. There was a star cast. There was commercial producer involved, even though this was at a nonprofit. And he said, okay, Karen, what else do you need from us? And I said, I need a Kardashian. and he was like, oh God, I'll never produce it again if it comes to that. And I'm like, I'm so sorry, but it's come to that, you know, where I know that to stand out in a crowded media market where more and more it has become about clickbait and sound bites, even at some very reputable outlets where you would never think that it would become about clickbait and sound bites and now that this is all measurable, the guys in accounting are knocking and they're saying, hey, why are we investing all of this money and resources into this type of coverage when nobody's clicking on it, so our readers aren't interested? And that's what we're dealing with now.
Right, especially for theater and fine arts, right?
Right.
Coverage. I've heard right. it's for entertainment, books, all those divisions are looking at the metrics really closely, right? It's not just theater, but theater gets the brunt of it, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, dance coverage just went away for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't want to end on that note. What we'll do is we'll go to the interview with James Still, and when we come back, you can plug whatever you want.
Okay, cool.
Okay. So, this is my interview with James Still, resident playwright at Indiana Repertory Theater. Enjoy. I'm here with James Still. He's the playwright in residence at Indiana Repertory Theater, and this is, you're going into your 20th year as in that role. Now, I'm speaking to you from, you are in Venice, California. Is that correct?
I'm in Santa Barbara.
Oh, California. Santa Barbara. Okay.
Yeah, I've been here doing a workshop of the new play. So, yep. But I live in Los Angeles, so I'll drive home today, and then I fly to Chicago tomorrow for rehearsals of a play of mine that's going on there.
Yeah. So. I think we wrote about Eric Pfeffinger actually wrote a wonderful piece in 2008 when you were about at the 10th year of that residency, which started in 97 or so. And I was just catching up with that. And then we also did write about Launchpad about 4 years ago.
I remember.
Which is the program at Santa Barbara, right?
Yeah.
A play development program in the school. It sounds like you, among your many play credits, you've also have a sort of you've explored the edges of how plays are made, right? With institutions, right?
Right.
I guess the thing to ask you about would be how this relationship with Indiana, if you retell the story, how that started, how you became, long before there was a push a couple years ago for playwrights in residence everywhere, a lot of places, and you were like a pioneer. So
Tell me about how that happened exactly.
Well, it's funny, Rob, because it feels, you know, there was a time where I felt like people were really interested in this story, and then we kind of became, you know, sort of like the old story, and so like people kind of lost interest in the story. But the thing was is that you know, like many writers, I was living in New York. I was working as a freelance writer, and Janet Allen at this, I'm going back to 1991 now. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a play that the Kennedy Center had commissioned and premiered that then won a contest that was housed at the IRT. So in 1991, as a playwright who had won this contest, I went to Indiana Repertory for the first time for a reading of a play of mine. I got there, and my agent at the time had sent an old draft, so they had been rehearsing the wrong draft of the play, and the whole thing was just, like, horrific for me as a writer, but we, you know, it was long before email and all that stuff, and so, you know, we had to go to Kinko's and make all these copies, because I bought this really crappy hard copy, you know, from my Daisy Wheel printer in my New York apartment, and but I met Janet then, and she was the associate artistic director, and we connected on some level. You know, with some people, you look in their eyes and you think, wow, this is somebody I hope I get to know.
Right.
And then she did a play of mine, like the next year. And then we kind of had a pen pal relationship, again, before email. So believe it or not, I would write her old-fashioned letters and say, hey, how are you? Mm-hmm. What are you doing? Here's what I'm doing. And then in 1996, in her first year as artistic director, after Libby Apple left the IRT and went to Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Janet became the artistic director. And in her first season, she programmed a new play of mine. And so I had my second production at the IRT. And so we were slowly creating a relationship based on work and mm-hmm. based on connection, a personal connection. And a year or so later, she called me up and said, hey, there's this grant that the Pew Charitable Trust are doing. It's a National Artist Residency Grant. It's a two-year grant. You don't have to move here. You have to spend time here. Would you want to apply? And, you know, well, I had never been a playwright in residence. The IRT had never had a playwright in residence. And so we applied, and honestly, Rob, I forgot that we had applied because, first of all, in those days, I never got grants. And so, you know, you go through the ritual of applying, but I quickly forgot about it.
Right.
And then Fran Kuman called me, and I was living in Venice, California at the time. And she called me, and she was like, James, you got it. You got it. I'm like, God, I was like, got what? I didn't know what she's talking about. So that grant took me to the IRT. And I really thought it was a two-year, you know, it was going to be 2 years, and I would commute back and forth, which I did. And I made the choice, rather than to spend a continuous, I think we had to spend 90 days over 2 years. And some writers chose to go for 3 months and, you know, just be there for 3 months. Mm-hmm. But I was really hungry for a relationship that stretched out over time. As someone who'd been a freelance writer and been treated very well at different theaters, I was aware that I was always a guest. Mm-hmm. And I was there for this intense time, and then I would leave, and with all good intentions, you know, everyone says, you know, you're going to come back. And sometimes you do, but many years can go by before that happens. And so I was interested in, what if I go every month? Mm-hmm. And I'm part of an ongoing culture of an institution, and also developing some kind of relationship with an audience that, again, is based on time rather than one project. Mm-hmm. And so we did that. And things, you know, went very well. And again, though, because the IRT had never had a playwright in residence, we really had to, you know, the board was kind of like, well, why do we need a playwright in residence? And right. I think the audience was like, what is a playwright in residence?
Right.
And so there was that process. But the beautiful thing was we were making it up because right. we didn't have an idea really what that was going to be, except for me, it was about immersion and connection and relationships. Okay. And so those three things were my focus. And then our Pew Grant got renewed, which you could apply for one renewal. So that stretched it out to 4 years. And by that time, the board had really bought into the idea. I was very involved. Janet was very gracious about putting me in the middle of everything that was happening in the theater. So I attended finance committee meetings and board meetings and staff meetings. And I was on the senior staff and the artistic staff. And I really got to jump in. Hmm. And experienced that, and because of that, I had lots of points of access, and likewise, lots of people had access to me.
Okay,
and that created again all kinds of relationship. And of course, you know, the most important thing during all that was that I was writing new plays, and the IRT was doing them.
Right.
So there was also, we were starting to develop a relationship with the audience around new work, and particularly around my new work.
Hmm. So
that's kind of that's the beginning.
Yeah, I've heard the phrase used. You were dramaturg in the institution, and I'm not. I think you said Janet was she a dramaturg, Janet Allen, or
she is.
She
identifies as a dramaturg still. Yeah,
and of course, it's funny. Always funny to use it as a verb. And we argue about how to spell it here.
Yeah, dramaturging.
But I think I know what that means. But could you talk a little bit more about? Of course, we're intrigued about how a residence works when you don't live there.
Sure.
But also just in general, like this idea that you have access and they have access to you, but you have some distance. I know Janet has spoken about in the piece we wrote before,
sure.
that was an important thing. I imagine that's important also to give you some space to write and have
a life. I mean, it's something I fight for because it's so easy, I think, for writers for our time to be claimed by anyone and everyone. And so, I mean, part of that, I think it was instinctive on my part. I've said this in interviews, and Janet knows this. I mean, there have been key moments over these 20 years where Janet has turned to me and said, you know, if you were ever going to move here, this would be the good time to do it. And, you know, when it comes down to it, Rob, I feel like had I moved there, oddly, I don't think I would have kept writing because I think I would have been consumed by being in it all the time. I would have been cleaning the bathrooms and, you know, handing out, you know, taking tickets and things because that's my nature. I want to be involved.
Right.
So part of it was a little bit of taking of self-care, you know,
right.
is that I needed to make sure that I continued my pursuit as a writer, both with the IRT and not with the IRT. And I think another reason why this has thrived is that I have never assumed that the IRT would do every play I write.
Mm-hmm.
And Janet has never assumed that I would, every play I write would be something, you know, that it would start with her and with the IRT. And so those other relationships are a part of my relationship with the IRT. And I think that generosity and also just honestly that maturity of understanding that a writer in a field of relationships that I must have many relationships, even though this is my primary artistic home. I've loved working at many theaters around the country, and that's been very important. But in the end, I come back to the IRT, of course. And the IRT has also, when we talk about, you know, the success of the residency, I mean, you know this, you've heard this from many writers, and you know this yourself. I mean, I hate to say this because it can sound almost arrogant, but honestly, getting a first production is not the hardest thing. It's the second production.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And the IRT has given me second productions multiple times.
Right.
And that production, after all of the pressure is off of the premiere and all of that intensive looking inward, there's something about that second production. And I, you know, so often the plays of mine that are published, you know, and they're always, I always wait for multiple productions, but, you know, it's been that IRT second production that's really helped me home in to what I was writing about.
It's funny. I was thinking the analogy to like an open marriage or something, like you're with one partner, but there's, you know, you're going to,
there's definitely a marriage. I mean, Janet says, you know, I'm like her second husband, and she calls me Joel, which is her husband's name, all the time. She calls me Joel by mistake all the time. Which I love, actually. And I love her husband's a stage manager who I've worked with many, many times. So, you know, I probably have called him Janet. Who knows? But, you know, I think going back to this idea of dramaturging, if you will, as a verb, the institution, I think part of that is about, and it, I should also say, it has been harder and harder to maintain an emotional distance. I mean, 20 years, you know, in the beginning, I was really the outsider. And so every question I had was a new question that hadn't been asked before because I was the only one not in the room all the time. Well, now I work very hard to maintain some kind of fresh perspective. But I see everything we do. You know, I see every production. I'm a part of those artistic conversations. I try to attend at least one rehearsal so I can view other directors, the writers, actors in process. You know, so my, it is still an immersive experience and it is still, you know, spread out through all points of access. But it, there's no question that it's harder over time to play that role successfully as the inside outsider.
Right.
And so dramaturg in the institution, I think what we meant 10 years ago and I think some version of that is still true, is that I certainly still try to provoke and ask sometimes the obvious question or the stupidest question. And, you know, sometimes it's a question that's already been asked, but I feel like that is part of my job.
I did have a couple questions. I mean, I don't know how granular you want to get about the residency, but is there a typical month for you? Like you mentioned a couple of days, are you commuting? Get very familiar with the commute, commuting on a particular airline a lot, you know. And obviously, that if you do, that hasn't gotten old. The sort of back and forth life that you.
I mean, anyone who travels knows that's not easy. The right. travel itself is grueling, and you know, remember, I started this before 9/11, and things changed drastically. In fact, you know, I remember flying back to the IRT just a few days after 9/11, one of the first days, and I was one of two people on that plane. It was flying, and so no, that is not romantic. It's not easy. It is, you know, it's hard on your body, it's hard on your psyche, everything about that. But you know, I try to be very practical about it and just say to myself, you know, there are people who live in Los Angeles, where I live, who commute 2 hours to work one way.
Yeah.
And, you know, the flight is 3 hours from LA to Indianapolis. So, I mean, yes, and we can have all kinds of, you know, ethical conversations about how I'm contributing to the demise of the environment by flying and my carbon footprint that I'm leaving because of this job and maybe I should have moved to India. I mean, believe me, I've thought of all of that you know, a citizen, of course. But in the end, I feel like that commute is still somehow part of what I do. It's part of what I do at the IRT. And also for me, and I think this is different for different writers, my commitment and ability to be mobile has also allowed me to have a career, you know, to be someone who could go on the road as needed. It's kept me in the theater. It's kept me as somebody employable.
So is there a typical month? There's a certain times of the month you go, a certain number of days you have to keep a minimum or no?
It's all based around what's going on at the theater. No, we don't keep score about that at all. It's all based on what's happening. So if there is a key, you know, if there's a key donor event, if there's a key meet and greet that I need to be at, of course, when it's my play, I'm there in and out. If I'm directing, then I'm there for a month and, you know, I direct every season. So I'm there for an entire month when that happens. But like next week or the week after I'm going there, I fly in on a Wednesday night. Thursday, I'm at a senior staff retreat. Friday morning, I'm at a senior staff retreat. Friday afternoon, Jenna and I will meet in the afternoon. And Friday night, I'll get on a plane. And so, you know, that's a 48-hour trip. That's a pretty fast one.
Yeah.
But I will do a lot of things in those. Sometimes I feel like I cram a month's worth of work into 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
I mean, it's you know, I run hard and fast when I'm there. But again, it's all it's pretty organic in terms of, you know, we may look at the season and say, well, in advance, Janet may say, I am hopeful you will be able to be here, you know, on these particular times.
Right.
And then I have that idea and then I can kind of work some of my schedule around that. And sometimes I can't. And, you know, usually I do. And but it's very much it's a responsive thing to the institution in terms of my time.
So I wanted to ask about I want to get to your plays, obviously, and what you're writing about, what you've written about. He's written a lot and quite a wide variety of just the plays that you sent me. There's just such a huge variety of topic and voice and tone. The only play of yours I've seen, I think, is Long Bridge Over Deep Waters, which was their culminating bridge show of Cornerstone's Faith Cycle, which I was very involved in. I worked on an early show at a Muslim school there.
Yes, I saw.
Oh, you saw that one? Okay.
I saw all of the. I mean, that was part of my thing. I trailed through all of that process, that 5 years, while I was doing my own story circles and interviewing people of all of these communities of faith. I was seeing everything and watching the development of all those plays as well, not knowing how the hell was I going to end up writing a play about all of these communities of faith. So,
to incorporate them all, So maybe that's a segue into, I want to ask about the institution and about Indianapolis itself, the city that you're a part-time resident in. So why don't we start with that, and then we'll ease into the plays, because one of the plays you sent me, April 4th, 1968, was created, I don't know if it was a story circle process, but it was created with residents of Indianapolis. And but just tell me a little bit about the city. I know you grew up in Kansas.
I grew up in a really tiny town. And I mean, in that way, I mean, Indianapolis, even though it's in the Eastern time zone, it's actually a very Midwestern city, in my opinion. Yeah. And I mean that in a good way, because it's something I understand. I grew up in a very small town about... well, now I guess it's probably an hour west of Kansas City, so in eastern Kansas. I'm a graduate of the University of Kansas in Lawrence. My family is still all in Kansas. It's I go back, you know. I mean, it's part of who I am. There's no question. So my being able to just go to Indianapolis and be there was initially very easy, because I felt like, oh, I kind of know this place. Mm-hmm. But like any place, it has its own rich and unusual history. And, you know, I've certainly, the nature of my projects, one of the first project I did there was a community project where I spent 3 years interviewing senior citizens in Indianapolis about the experience of growing up over the course of the 20th century, because we were looking at the turning of the millennium to the year 2000.
Okay.
So I spent time. And that was a great crash course in Indiana and Indianapolis history, because they all had stories, of course, about what it was to grow up there and grow up through World War II and civil rights and all of that through the perspective of being citizens of Indianapolis and Indiana. So that was a wonderful crash course, and people were very generous because I was so stupid about all of that history, that local history. And also, you know, because I've been there, going there for 20 years now, I've also watched it change, you know, incredibly. I mean, the downtown is, you know, quite a destination now, and there are many, many hotels, but they're always full. And of course, they hosted the Super Bowl a few years back, and that was a huge event. And, you know, it's kind of a way for the city to come out to the rest of the country in terms of being this great place to come. And, you know, there's some great businesses there. So there are people, there's an international community there as well. People who are, you know, brought in from all around the world. Some who come to the IRT, who I've gotten to know, some who are on our board. I would say people are often surprised.
Okay.
In fact, I think there was a thing in the New York Times not while ago, you know, something like the most surprising city in America. It was like in the travel section. It was about Indianapolis.
Huh.
You know, that there's actually, you know, some really great restaurants. And, of course, there's a great theater there and other theaters there as well. And sports and all those things.
It's not just a racetrack, right?
No, it is not just race. I have been to the race once. I'm not a race car person, so okay. I did it once though to get what that was.
Okay, and there was no pressure. Like, you're going to write a play about the Indy 500? Obviously, no.
There was a short play written about it that we did this year, actually, by another writer, which is where Tom Horan wrote that, and was wonderful.
So I don't want to necessarily steer this to politics, but I know that it's a it's trending a little purpler, Indiana. Mm-hmm. I think the only time they voted Democratic was 2008. Actually, the year.
Correct.
You
President Obama.
Yeah, looking over the president's mm-hmm. looking over the president's shoulder premiered there around that time. I think.
Just, well, actually, that was the second production.
Oh, second production.
That was the
okay.
second time the IRT had done it. Actually, we premiered it. Right after 9/11, that's the play I was writing when 9/11 happened.
Oh,
I was looking
wow.
over the president's shoulder. So it was actually a very deep experience for me because, like everyone, I was asking myself, you know, what's the point? And, you know, as an artist, what can I do? And then, you know, it turned out, for listeners who don't know, that's a solo play. It's based on a real person named Alonzo Fields, who was an African-American, Indiana-born and raised man who was trained to be an opera singer, and during the Depression, when he couldn't get a job as an opera singer, as an African-American man, he became a butler at the White House and ended up being the chief butler from 1931 to 1953 through four U.S. presidents.
Yeah.
And so he was my company during that awful time and really kind of spoke to me from his grave about what it is to be a patriot, what it is to be American, and, you know, what all of that can mean. And so I was extremely grateful for Alonzo Fields' company during that time.
So I wondered, and some of my family history, my family's from Gary originally, which is, I know, a totally different, mm-hmm. totally different.
Yeah, it is, right.
Part of Indiana. It's almost Chicago. Although, yeah, there's suburbs, ring suburbs there. But, so I know a little bit of the Indiana, experience and zeitgeist or whatever it is. I don't know if you could say anything about the way that you think it's changed. Do you feel like you have any insight living in a coastal city in a very blue state?
Yes. I'm aware that I very happily live in a very blue state. That's a choice I'm very happy I've made in my life. But I also, you know, there's something to be said for not flying over
Yes.
that red state called right. Indiana, yeah. instead landing at that airport
yeah.
and talking to my Uber drivers and talking to the people who come to our theater. Yeah, look, I mean, it's a tricky time.
Yeah.
And I'm not being coy here. I mean, anyone who knows my political bent, and if you don't, I'm a very hard-leaning liberal progressive.
Sure.
And that is, I take that very seriously. But I also take listening and debate very seriously as well. I'm not interested in no conversation.
Right.
As an artist, I'm not interested in that. And as a citizen, I'm not interested in that. So I often find myself in conversations with people who, and I will tell you, when I first started at the IRT, I was afraid of that.
Okay.
I was afraid of those conversations. I was afraid that somehow I was, you know, not being true to myself in some way, you know. And I've grown up,
okay.
you know, about that because I have come to value those conversations. Not that I'm not made uncomfortable sometimes.
Sure.
Because I am. And I'm sure I've made them uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, because I try to be true and... But I also, like I said, I believe, you know, as a writer, you know, one of my big things is that writing is about listening. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a good segue into April 4th, 1968, because
yeah.
that really, for me, was what I call a community listening project. And by that, I mean, it's another version of Story Circles, although with that project, I did less Story Circles and more one-on-one interviews where I interviewed people who had some primary relationship with that event in Indianapolis. Again, listeners who may not know, Senator Robert Kennedy was scheduled to make a campaign stop in Indianapolis on April 4th, 1968. He was running for president in the Democratic primary, which was a few weeks away. Lyndon Johnson had announced he was not going to run again, and mm-hmm. so the field was wide open.
Right.
And Kennedy was coming to the IRT, to Indianapolis, although his headquarters were in the IRT building.
I read that somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great thing. But he had just given a speech in Muncie at Ball State, and the story is that as he was leaving that venue to get on the plane to fly to the very short flight to Indianapolis, like 30 minutes, someone told him, have you heard the news? And he hadn't, and it was that Dr. King had been shot, and they didn't know yet. By the time he had landed in Indianapolis, they knew Dr. King had died.
Right.
And Senator Kennedy was scheduled to give an outdoor speech in a predominantly African-American neighborhood near downtown. And the mayor at the time, which was then later Senator Lugar, and the police chief at the time, said to Kennedy, don't give the speech. We cannot guarantee your safety. Hmm. And Kennedy said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go and talk. And he gives, and people can watch this on YouTube. It's absolutely beautiful. Less than 5 minute speech. And what I've called, I'm not the first to say this, but I feel this, it's sort of the Gettysburg Address of the 20th century. And he delivered the news to that. Many of those people did not know. It's hard to believe in our era.
Wow.
They didn't. We didn't have 24/7 people, you know, unless they had their radios on, the TVs on, and they'd been waiting in the park for him as well for quite a while.
Wow.
So that was part of, so the thing that drew me to this project was Indianapolis was the only major city in the United States not to have sort of civil violence, riots. After that night, if you know, I mean, Washington, D.C. burned, Chicago burned, Detroit burned. I mean, there, you know, it was a horrible night in American history for so many people. There was so much pain and no way to express that. And Indianapolis did not. And so there was a, you know, what I set out was to discover what's the myth and what's the truth, because some people to this day say it was because of Bobby Kennedy's speech, mm-hmm. and other people say, you know, there are only 1,000 people at that speech. That's not why.
Yeah.
So it's the tone. Indianapolis was not going to riot. Nothing would make them riot because, you know, that's who they are. So I really set out to sort of, you know, thinking that was going to be the question. That turned out to be actually the least interesting question and actually the least interesting thing about the whole thing. Because, you know, I mean, the facts are the facts. It didn't happen. We'll never really know why it happened. What became interesting for me were all of the personal experiences that people had on that day. So I interviewed many people who were at the park, mm-hmm. who heard the speech. I interviewed people who, a lot of people who had been in college at the time, who were Bobby Kennedy supporters, who were anti-Vietnam, and who were becoming political for the first time. Remember, you couldn't vote until you were 21 in 1968. So these were kids who were throwing their lives into this, even though they were not going to be able to vote themselves.
Wow.
And so I was very interested in that desire to participate politically in a process where you really didn't have a voice, at least not a vote. So I interviewed them. I interviewed people who had been part of Kennedy's local campaign. Of course, I interviewed people. Dr. King had been in Indianapolis several times, and so I interviewed people in churches who knew him or had hosted him. So, and that was a 4-year listening project where I listened to people for 4 years, and then I went off and wrote a play, not a documentary play. The play that you read was a play that was inspired. It was a fictional family that was not based on any one interview, but was really based on my experience of listening to those people and feeling great empathy and terror at that, you know, on that night, what had happened. And it was a very deep experience for me. It was a wonderful and terrifying writing experience.
So I wondered, you know, in the menu of options you have to write plays, and like the, I'm sure there are commissions, and there are people asking you for plays. You range freely across. You do historical plays. Historical-based plays, you've done plays that, whether or not they're at IRT, they're about, and they come from the community there, or about that community. You're resident in Indiana rep. You live in California, but your imagination seems to range freely through time and across the world. Right.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, like, the way I like to look at it is that I feel like I try to let my curiosity lead me. And you know, for me, there's no shortage of things I want to write about. There's only a shortage of time. For me, curiosity is the big driver. Mm-hmm. And the liability of that, of course, is that it takes you many places. I mean, if you're a curious person, that means, you know, you find yourself in Plymouth in 1637 and Indianapolis in 1968 and Yemen in 2014. But again, I would say, I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm a writer, right? Is that I love that immersive experience of kind of, you know, that radical empathy, that vivid compassion that you have for these people that may be an invention. Because I am drawn to so many things, I have learned over the years to try to understand the difference between a crush and a love story. Hmm. So I come up with I gravitate toward an idea or a feeling or, you know, just something, a stirring about, you know, something that could be something I'll write. And I ask myself, you know, okay, I'm clearly crushing on this, but is it love? Because crush will not sustain itself over the time that it's going to take for me to write this play, to really write it. Mm-hmm. So I spend time then saying, okay, I'm crushing. Crushes are fun. I'm going to crush on this idea, if you will. And then when enough time passes, I sort of test that and I'm like, okay, am I still crushing or is this love or has it kind of, you know, gone away? And when I feel that shift, when I'm like, okay, this has turned into something passionate and deep, then I go for it. And so like with A New World, my new play that's set in Plymouth, you know, there's a million reasons not to write a play set in Plymouth in 1637, not the least of which, even though, by the way, it happened 55 years before Salem, everyone's going to say, oh, this is the gay crucible, you know, which, you know, pisses me off because right. It's so much more than that. But I get it. That's going to be the shorthand and that's the risk I take.
Sure.
But, you know, I spent many, many months digging into that research, and the research is a way to sort of pass the time in a very active way while I'm crushing, you know, right. It's sort of like, well, I'll just research for a while and kind of see how it happened. Well, you know, a few months into that, and I'm like, oh my God, I have to write this play. I have to give these guys, time in contemporary history now. And so, once that happens, then, that burden, that great burden begins, the burden of taking on someone else's story.
So tell me, to close out here, it's been about 20 years, with IRT. Do you look forward? Is there a conversation about, you know, let's keep doing this as long as we, as long as it works.
Yeah. Such a great question, Robin. And, you know, Janet and I, again, I have never taken it for granted that it would go on forever. I never would have imagined it would go on for 20 years. And so I have periodically stopped and asked myself, hey, you know, is this really, is this still dynamic or is this a habit? And then I also talk with Janet about that. I'm like, am I still useful to the organization? Am I still bringing something that, is an agent of change, mm-hmm. or am I status quo, you know, because I don't really want to play that role. And so we do revisit that. I will say, you know, it's hard not to, I mean, 20 is like, that seems like a big marker. And so it is hard to not, I mean, it's kind of unprecedented, right, in the American theater in terms of this kind of residency and relationship. And, you know, certainly we know, you know, Circle Repertory had incredible long-term relationship with writers over many, many years.
Right.
And that was its own thing. And this is a very different kind of residency, if you will. But I know that it's unique and it's beautiful. And I know that unique and beautiful things don't last forever. So, you know, I will revisit that as I always have. And, I will sound like a cliche now, but, you know, I want to, whenever it's time to stop, I want it to stop at a really great moment. I don't want it to be like, you know, oh my God, is he still the playwright in residence? Which I hear people are saying now, you know, it's like, wait, sure. You mean he's still doing that? But that's just because they don't know. And hopefully our conversation will, you know, enlighten, you know, why it's possible and why it has been rich. But I don't want it to become that, obviously. I don't want it to be like, oh my God, they're still, you know, he's still doing that.
Well, no,
and for the audiences also, I don't want them to feel like, oh God, could we just have another writer? You know, I'm just sick of seeing James Still's plays. Because this is something else we didn't talk about, Rob, which I do want to mention.
Yeah, it's, please.
It's incredible, which is that we have many audience members at the IRT who have seen 15 of my plays.
It's amazing.
You know, I mean, so I can have a conversation with a person who has seen in production, and you talked about how different my plays are. So you can imagine how interesting those conversations are. And what surprises me are, you know, when they talk about what their favorites are, which I never think about for me. You know, I don't have favorites in my plays. I don't look back. I'm always looking forward. But I always think, you know, there's always my place where I think, oh my God, everybody hated this play. And lo and behold, someone will say, oh my God, that was my favorite play of yours that you ever did. And I'll be like, are you kidding me? Wow, I had no idea anyone liked that play. But okay, that's great. So I do want to mention that's another incredible dividend, both for me as an artist and for the institution and for our audience, that they have this. They have an ongoing relationship with an artist and with a body of work that, you know, unless it's Shakespeare, I don't know what other writers, you know, an audience can have that with.
I mean, it's a unique model. There's a signature theater, but you can only see about three or four of those of a playwright in a season. And I'm trying to think if I've seen that many plays by any playwright, except for Shakespeare. August Wilson. There's 10, but that's
right.
And they're spread over many different theaters all over the country. It's not at one place. That's amazing. It's a unique model, which I know other folks are experiencing. Now, I don't know if you've talked to any of your playwright colleagues who are doing these residencies around the country.
I've read on All Round, of course.
Right.
You know, the testimonies, which is very exciting. And, you know, I mean, I feel like an elder, you know, when I read those. You know, like I'm like, oh, my God, you know, I remember those feelings, or I remember how that happened or whatever. But I think that, you know, it's an amazing thing. And I'm so glad Mellon is doing that.
The excitement of having your own desk and business card, that might have worn off at some point.
I have to say. In fact, I never have my business card with me now. I'm always like, oh, damn, I forgot those. I have a huge box, and I never have them anymore. But,
well, you know, however long it lasts, it's been an amazing, ride. And it's shaped and defined your career, you know?
It has. It has. You know, and another thing I want to say is that a lot of people, you know, that question of, well, how does it work? How do you do it? Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, the idea is, it can you replicate this? And I would say no, because it's all about chemistry.
Right.
It's all about relationship.
Right.
And, you know, if Janet hadn't been the artistic director that whole time, I mean, there's no artistic director is going to come in and be like, oh, I'm going to keep James Still on, who's been in here forever and was Janet's playwright. I'm aware of that, you know?
Yeah,
so
sure.
There are many things that have aligned to make this possible. And I just want to say again, it comes from Janet's willingness to open the doors to an outsider, to a writer, you know, to a nosy, curious writer, and say, come on in, sit at this table, and be a part of our conversation. And so it's been a 20-year conversation.
Well, it sounds like you're both better for it. James, it's been a great chance to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
All right, we're back, and we have a couple recommendations of things to see, think about, read. I also want you to start off.
All right. So I just returned from the National Critics Institute at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center. So I'm still catching up on sleep and have not seen a whole lot of theater as of late. But I will say that one show that I saw in development while at the Eugene O'Neill Center was Superhero, which is a new musical by Tom Kitt and John Logan. And it stars Kelly O'Hara, and I'm sure you'll all be hearing more about it in the coming months. So just keep your ears peeled for that.
Sounds cool. Karen, what you have? Plug whatever you want.
Not one of mine. Okay. I'm keeping the wall up. To listen, I recommend Mac Rogers, his Steal the Stars, the podcast, the weekly podcast, little bits of Mac Rogers every week in your ears is always sort of a great thing. It's very cool. You know, all the stuff Mac is known for, weirdo characters and weirdo situations. It's a fun sci-fi piece with a lot of really great downtown acting talent in it. So you can find that on tour.com's website, and I think it's on Stitcher and iTunes and all those good places.
So you just look for Steal the Stars, you can find it.
Yeah, Steal the Stars.
Okay, yeah, I haven't listened to it yet. Listen to The Message. I was a big fan of that. And I didn't. The Live After, was it Live After? There was another, he did another one after, and I haven't listened to that yet. I'm still catching up with the Mac Rogers oeuvre. He's very productive and prolific.
Yes, he is.
Summer's you know, Shakespeare time, so I would just say it's been an interesting summer for Shakespeare. Wasn't a huge fan of Julius Caesar, was very much a non-fan of Hamlet. We're talking public theater. But I really did like the Midsummer Night's Dream that they just, I think that's, I should know whether that's still running or not. I don't think it's still running. Is it still running? Anyway, Lyre de Bessonnet graduated from directing the public works to directing one of the main stages at the Delacorte. And, you know, Midsummer, I've seen metric tons of Midsummers. I don't need to see it anymore. And my wife didn't go with me. She's like, I've seen it enough. It's like, I've often felt that way about Midsummer. I felt that way years ago. I don't ever need to see another one. But I'll go because when it's good, it's a delight. And this one is what I found to be a delight. Is it still running?
No? Through August 13th.
Through August 13th. So you can still catch it if you stand in line. It stresses the comedy, but it has a certain grace about it. Anyway, I very much liked it. And I'm just, this is a sort of a looking ahead. I thought about taking my 8-year-old to his first Shakespeare play, but it starts at 8, it's a 3-hour play. But coming along in a couple weeks is As You Like It, the Public Works production, which is going to have wrestling in it with an actual wrestling troupe. It's only 90 minutes. It's got music. It does start late, but I think As You Like It's as good a play to introduce a kid to Shakespeare. I don't know. 8 is young, but, you know, I figure Jason Zinnemann has introduced Penny, his daughter, to Julius Caesar, you know, Alien, Jaws. So I'm trying to catch up. anyway. Is your kid a fan of theater at all? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, God, when she was 10, I took her to see Mike Bartlett's Bull.
Wow, cool.
Yeah. I've been taking her for years since she was real young. So she was good with it. And she was a huge fan of one of the actors in it from a BBC series that we watched.
Oh, cool.
She does really well with it, and not the kids stuff.
Right. Oh, that's good.
She actually doesn't do well with the kids stuff.
I was able to tell Oliver and my other son that we saw Poe Dameron in a play recently, Hamlet. That is, he wasn't that interested though. It's like, and he probably would not have liked Hamlet for all 4 hours of it, or understood what was happening. In any case, Karen, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks
Allison.
For having me.
You can rate us on iTunes, find us on all different platforms. The links to what we discussed will be on the show page. Thanks for listening.